Squirrel Hill from East End, where we, after we were married, we had an apartment there. And I don't remember whether we were members. Probably we were not members of the temple at that time. We decided to join Temple Sinai at that time, and there are many conservative synagogues in Squirrel Hill that I might have gone to. But by that time, whatever set of critical incidents had occurred had, I think, congealed in my mind, and it wasn't because my wife was brought up Reform. My wife was brought up conservative, the same way I was. We were married at Beth Shalom, and I think her parents were members of Beth Shalom. And yet, when we started our own family, I opted, and she with me, to go to Bnei Israel, to go to Temple Sinai, and I am certain that while I don't think it was conscious, I sat down and said, "Here are the three things that happened in the conservative synagogue." I was not attracted to the set of images that represented to me. It's very unfair, but I think it's true that many of the events that occur that are critical incident oriented and are not representative of the institutions which one is exposed to do remain as important triggers of memory and aggregate as images in your mind when later decisions are made, even though they may not be explicitly trotted out. To this day, my wife often says, let's leave Temple Sinai and go to a conservative. I miss it. And I don't miss it. And we've never agreed on that. But and then when I became president of Temple Sinai, I obviously felt a kind of commitment not to do that at all. But I think that some of those experiences, which were essentially negative, were very much in the forefront of the process by which that kind of decision was made. And I had spent some time at Rosh Hashanah, and while I fell in love with Solomon Freehoff and his sermons and the intellectuality they represented, I did not find that was a place that I wanted to associate myself with. I found it at that time too sterile for me, and so we eventually opted for the Temple Sinai, which felt to be somewhat less sterile. But I think if my experiences had been more positive and conservative, we probably would have opted for a more conservative experience. It's hard to know, but because those decisions are often taken without a great deal of thought, the motivations are perhaps created by the previous experiences, but they operate almost in an automatic fashion to move you toward the decision. If somebody said, "Why did you make that decision?" you really wouldn't be able to sit down and say, "Here are the seven reasons I made that decision." It's just that I felt that was the right thing to do. When I sit back and try to analyze it now, I know that some of these experiences, which are triggered by taking time, which I never do, no one ever does, I guess, but sort of think about what were the experiences of your early upbringing that brought you into certain situations. I know that those were critical to
I found it interesting that you, when you spoke about your early years or just growing up, almost up until your university years, it was mostly in the East End of town. Did you have any interaction with going to downtown Pittsburgh, with Squirrel Hill, with anywhere else?
Well, did either of you grow up in East Liberty or East End? There was a very decided competition between Squirrel Hill and East End at that time. We spoke very negatively of Squirrel Hill people. They were a type of Jew that we did not want to emulate. They represented, in a sense, and this, of course, is a terrible thing to say, and you know, you have to understand, we're young, impressionable teenagers, but you often hear people speak negatively about the stereotype represented by a New York Jew. Well, to us, the Squirrel Hill Jews were that stereotype. We didn't know anything about New York Jews. but they were uppity, they were materialistic, they were concerned only about what they owned, and the young were about their social fraternities and sororities, about their clothes, and so on. Now, there's a great deal of jealousy here. These were more affluent Jews in Squirrel Hill. These were more professional Jews in Squirrel Hill. And they looked down terribly on the East End Jews. There was a hierarchy here, and we were at the bottom end of it. And so we developed defense mechanisms, which sort of said, we don't want to associate with these elitists up there. They're not very nice people to begin with, and besides that, all they think about is their money and so on. And so we did stay mostly in East End. Now, we'd go periodically to Polonsky's, which is now, after a number of iterations, Rhoda's, and that was sort of a...
In Squirrel Hill.
In Squirrel Hill. That was sort of a move to a foreign country, so to speak. But you'd go and have Saturday night after the movie sandwiches or something in Polonsky's. And so we occasionally ventured. But remember, at that time, the Y was in Oakland. And we did go to the Y. That's where AZA met. And there was swimming there. And
this
so
was the Y...
This was the YMHA, and YMHA, which was in Oakland, is now Belfield Hall at the University of Pittsburgh. And so we did go there. We'd get on the streetcar or the bus, and later driving, and we'd go to the Y, which was the heart of a great deal of our Jewish communal life, because there wasn't anything in East Liberty, or there wasn't any JCC. The only other thing was on the Hill, the Irene Kaufman Settlement, and we obviously, during that period, we did not get on the Hill, and that was deteriorating. So the Y in Oakland was where we went. Did we go downtown? Yeah, we would periodically go downtown, but not very often. Going downtown was quite a jaunt. And downtown was a place where you went for shopping with your parents, and you got Kaufman's, Gimbel's, Horns, and Rosenbaum's. you're probably not old enough to remember Rosenbaum's, but... and so we did do a lot of shopping down there, but it was not a social sort of thing. That is, we didn't go down and congregate on the streets. We might go downtown for a movie, or we might go downtown for shopping, but we were extremely tied in to the geographical area where we went, except for the Y, which was in Oakland. We went to school, and we did our movies.
And culturally, your family did.
Yeah,
now, mostly there.
We didn't do much in the way of culture in those days, as culture is known now. We didn't go to the symphony. There was no opera in that time, and it just sort of wasn't thought of. There wasn't a great deal of culture, as I think about it. There was very little discussion of art. That sort of thing was not in the background generally of our parents. They had been forced to spend all their time making a living. Getting along, and they didn't have, there wasn't much opportunity for them to get us involved, because they themselves had not been involved in sort of the cultural dimension of life. The socialization had to do with Friday night dinners and getting uncles and aunts over and Sunday visiting kinds of things. There was a great deal of sort of family and friend orientation. I mean, it was a time where I would go to my friends' houses every night at the same night, at the same time after dinner. And we would do something, and we might just walk around, or we might take a ride, or we might go to a movie, or we might play miniature golf, or we might read, or we might play a game. But it was just, after dinner, I would take off, if I didn't have homework to do or something, and go and spend time with a friend, or I'd call the friend up, so I'd time on the telephone. Vehicle for communication, but it was mostly what are you going to do today, tonight kind of thing. Or and there were times when you had to do homework, and you got older, you couldn't do that except on the weekend.
And yet in high school, World War II was going on. Were you influenced at all by that? Did you?
Surprisingly little. I was only when 11 years old when World War II started, and I was sort of 15 or so, 16 when it was over. I remember listening to the radio in my living room when Pearl Harbor attack was announced, but I don't remember the war as having much of an impact. I remember some things. I remember at my bar mitzvah, which was in 1943, in which we had the reception in the Shemmy Hotel, which is now the Student Union of the university, we could only have ice cream to be served because nothing else was available because of the war. So we had like coffee and ice cream. And I remember being disappointed that that was all we could have at the bar mitzvah. There were a couple of critical incidents like that. But in general, we didn't have any family members involved in the war. The parent generation was too old to get in, and the child generation was too young to get in. So there was nobody in our family, so to speak, who was affected by the war directly because they were in the service and so on. And while, you know, we say, gee, my uncle was supposed to have made a reasonable amount of money because he had access to silk stockings for women, which were in terribly short supply during the war, and he had a source for this. I mean, one remembers little things like that. But as far as the war having an impact negatively, it was just a sort of state of life that we learned to live with.
You didn't have your friend's siblings weren't in the war, or you,
I don't remember that being the case.
Or you didn't look at the headlines of the newspapers every day.
Yes, we did that. We talked about it at school and so on, but it was still like far away. It was like reading about Somalia. You know, of course you're concerned about it, but you know, Somalia is over there in Africa somewhere, and it's not having an impact, I think, on our kids as much as possible.
There we go.
Today is February 22nd, 1993. Judy Rubenstein and Mimi Bly are interviewing Dr. Zofer, Jerry Zofer. The last time, Dean, we talked about your adolescent years, and today we'd like to begin with your education. Could you tell us...
Well, I went to Fulton Elementary School. Mm-hmm. You're taking me way back. I presume you want to go all the way
right.
back to the beginning,
right.
as they say. And I went there for, I guess, from kindergarten through eighth grade. And I spent 4 years at Peabody High School. And then, at that time, I was prepared to go to college. But there's only one college or one university that seemed to be available to me. I didn't even think about anything else, and that was the University of Pittsburgh, primarily because by that time my father had died, and my, I guess, junior or senior year in high school, and I needed to stay around to help support the family, so I wasn't going anywhere. University of Pittsburgh seemed the only choice, so I spent 4 years at the University of Pittsburgh, working about half the time at the university and then working to support my family the other half of the time, which was not the best way to go to school, but was the only feasible way for me.
What year did you enter the University of Pittsburgh?
I entered the University of Pittsburgh in 1948, and I was fortunate enough to receive a scholarship. They gave a scholarship, I think, one male and one female scholarship to each Pittsburgh senior class. I was fortunate enough to receive the honor scholarship from the Peabody High School, and so that made it very feasible for me to go to school, which would have been difficult otherwise. And so I spent 4 very hectic years at the University of Pittsburgh. I did manage to join a fraternity and enjoy some of the...
What fraternity was that?
Kappa Nu. It's mm-hmm. a fraternity that's no longer in on the national scene. It is part of a large conglomerate of fraternities that I think are now under the Zeta Beta Tau banner. There were 3 or 4 of them, but we were all independent at that time. So I did have a little bit of college flavor and did enjoy that opportunity. But I sort of went from into classes between 8 and 12 and worked between 12 and 5 and then did homework between 6 and 12 or whatever. And
What kind of work did you do?
Well, when my father died, he was in the insurance business and had an insurance agency. Unfortunately, my mother was not experienced at all in that kind of business, though she went into the business immediately, and I went in with her at the time, and that was our source of support for a long time, and until I decided to go into education, but which I did very inadvertently, actually. When I finished my undergraduate work, which I was a reasonably good student, I was asked if I'd like to continue and go into the master's program. Since I enjoyed it, I said that I would. And when I finished that, somehow, I was getting a little bored with the pace of commercial life and decided I'd just continue on for my doctorate. And I did that. And then, as soon as I finished the doctorate, someone asked me if I wouldn't like to teach a course 8 o'clock in the morning before I went to work. And I could be at work at 9 o'clock. And I thought that sounded an intriguing way to do business. Start off with an intellectual experience every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 8 o'clock, and then go on and earn your livelihood. In those days, you didn't earn a livelihood very much in teaching, particularly as a part-time person. So I taught a course from 8 to 9 in the morning and continued with my insurance agency operations. And I had a good time. I really enjoyed it. It was fun, and I think I was reasonably well received by the students. The next year, they asked me if I'd like to teach two courses since I was already there at 9 o'clock. Why didn't I stay on until 10 o'clock and teach a second course in a new subject? And that sounded pretty exciting to me because I was doing reasonably well with the first one, so I did that. And the third year, they asked me, since I was there at 10 o'clock, why didn't I stay on till 11 o'clock and teach three courses on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday? So I stayed and taught three courses. And the next year, when the head of the department came to me, I said, no, 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 no more. I've had enough. He said, well, he said, if you teach just one night course at night, he said, you wouldn't have to take any more time from your business, and we can put you on a full-time line, and that will be much more remunerative for you. So I thought to myself, well, I'm a businessman, that makes a lot of sense. And so I agreed. And that evening class turned out to be a professional class in insurance, which is what I was teaching. And I enjoyed those professional students a lot. And so I found myself on a full-time line. And here I was with two full-time careers. I felt, gee, I needed really to spend more time with the students. I should have longer office hours. And I really ought to do some of the research that faculty require to do, and I really need to get into some of the committee work and so on. And so I had a long conversation with my wife about that I had finally inadvertently discovered something I really liked. While I was forced into the insurance business because it was the only option available to me at the time, and I didn't dislike it that much, I really couldn't see myself for my entire life in that line of work. My wife said, well, you do come home and you complain about personnel problems, and you do complain about difficulties in the marketplace, and you do complain about the problems of advertising, and you do complain about an awful lot of things. And I said, well, it's a really serious decision to make because we would have to cut our income very substantially if we did this. And so she said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I really like the idea of shaping young minds as a way of spending your time in life. And if you'd be willing to maybe go to work after the kids are grown a little bit, it would be really wonderful if I could undertake this kind of career. So we talked about my need for shaping the careers of young minds, and what a marvelous way that would be to contribute to the community and self-satisfaction and so on. And so we made the decision, and eventually I sold the business and got out completely, and then continued to be in the academic scene. After a few years of that, somebody discovered that I had once managed an office and people, and they thought, here's somebody we can put into an administrative role. So the next thing somebody said, well, why don't you cut out this one course you have and devote a little time to administration? And the next year they said, hey, you're doing that pretty well. Why don't you cut out two courses and we're going to give you a little bit more administration? So pretty soon I was down to one course and doing a lot of administration. I didn't really realize what had happened until I inadvertently passed by the telephone where my wife was talking to a friend of hers, and I could hear her say, apropos of nothing that I knew of, he's not a bad guy, but he's not that smart. And so I didn't really know what was going on. I suddenly realized she was talking about me and didn't know that I was in the room. She said, yes, it used to be he complained about budgets and managing people and advertising and all those problems. And he said, so he went into higher education to get rid of all that. And now he's complaining about budgets and personnel, and he's doing it for half the price that he did when he was in business. So he's a pretty nice guy, but as you can see, he's not too smart. He's got the same problems now he did 5 years ago, and he's being paid half as much for it. And I realized, indeed, that it happened. And so pretty soon, I ended up being a full-time administrator. That's essentially how I eased from being an insurance salesman into academia, and I've never regretted all that.
You talked about being able to mold young minds. Do you feel that you're able to do that as effectively administrating rather than teaching?
Well, it's a different kind of situation. I think that you have to feel that you're operating somewhat more vicariously. While I do get a chance to spend time with students, it's certainly not in the same direct way that you do as a classroom teacher. But you are able to create environments in which other people can, I think, more effectively shape young minds. And so I have to look at it as sort of a leveraged arrangement where I can leverage the position to have greater effect on more young minds than I would if the labor-intensive arrangement of just faculty member and student were involved. And for a number of years, I continued to teach until my schedule got so convoluted and the positions that I was in continued increasing in scope to the point where I couldn't show up every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 9 o'clock or any other time because of my travel schedule and so on. So eventually I had to get out of the business of teaching individual classes, though one of the things that keeps me going from day to day is the expectation that at some point I will go back to the classroom and try to make a contribution once again with individual students. But it got to the point where when I was teaching towards the end of that part of my career, I would be in a classroom lecturing, and lecturing reasonably efficiently, but I wasn't paying any attention to what I was doing. My mind was elsewhere, thinking about other things. But I've been doing it for a number of years by that time, and I was sort of on automatic. And that scared me, because I was still able to turn it on sufficiently, evidently, so that the students were not unhappy with the results. But I certainly wasn't into it in the same way. And that's one of the reasons that I felt, well, a little administration might sort of take me out of this period and reinvigorate me a little bit. Maybe I was getting a little bit stale in the classroom teaching term after term. And so I was easily seduced into some administrative work at that point. Well, those things have a way of catching up to you, and some success breeds more opportunity. And pretty soon, when they found I could hopefully manage something more than my own desk, I got more opportunities to do that sort of thing. And over time, I've had an opportunity to do some things that I'm very proud of and very pleased with, and have been very excited. And I'm glad that my wife married such a young guy, because I think I would have been a lot less satisfied and pleased than if I continued. And frankly, I think some of the things that I've done that I talked with you about last time, such as my foray at the University Club, for example, wouldn't have been possible had I not been in the position, mm-hmm. because I represented a kind of position as well as an individual at that time. And so some of those opportunities would not have been made possible.
If we could just back up a few minutes to what did you major in as an undergraduate?
As an undergraduate, I majored initially in accounting. I had, for some strange reason, unbeknownst to me, decided that since I was reasonably proficient in accounting and kind of liked it, that I ought to be a CPA, because that was the way to earn my living. And there was no other option at the time in terms of business I was in, because Pitt at that time didn't have any work in insurance, which was the field that I was studying. About my junior year, the university was given some money and hired a professor of insurance. His name was Archibald Malcolm Woodruff. And he came to Pitt and established the Department of Insurance and Real Estate. And because I was in that business, I thought this was a marvelous opportunity, and I immediately changed my major from accounting to insurance. So I am sort of a half accounting major, and I've taught accounting, actually. But I never completed it at all because I shifted into insurance. So I would say for the first 2 years I majored in accounting, and the last 2 years I majored in insurance. And then when I continued my graduate work, I did it in insurance. And then I did my doctorate in economics. At the time, that was the only field offering a doctorate. Though I wrote my thesis on an insurance subject, the doctorate is in economics. So I majored in accounting and insurance as an undergraduate, insurance as a master's level candidate, and economics as a PhD.
Were there any other professors who were influential on your life?
Yes, there was. I suspect that Arch Woodruff, who later became dean of the business school at George Washington University and then went on to be president for a number of years before he died of the University of Hartford, was the most influential on my life. He recognized, I guess, some intrinsic interest and hopefully some talent. In my entire formative years, I never had the aspiration of going on to get a doctorate. I didn't even know what it was, and it never occurred to me to have a university career. And my family was in business all its life, and I figured I would end up as a businessman, one form or another. And accounting was sort of a compromise between my business expectations and, how shall I put it, my academic and professional aspirations. Also, somehow an accountant was in business, but he was more professional than an insurance salesman. So I was sort of, somehow had managed to combine the sort of expectation of me to be in business with my sort of own expectation of something a little more professional. But Arch Woodruff sensed in me some set of talents or interests.